Goeienaand, baie welkom by Sterre en Planete. Is vanavond 'n besondere program, want gewoonlik die eerste Sondag in die maand het ons vir Jim Adams daar in Amerika, maar Jim is nie in Amerika op die oomblik nie, maar hy sit hier by ons in die ateljee in Pretoria. Goeienaand, Jim.
Goeienaand, Henny.
En saam met hom is Bianca Rim. Sy is 'n elektroniese ingenieur by NASA. Good evening, Bianca.
Good evening.
Right, let's start off, Jim. Why are you in South Africa?
Yeah, I'm in South Africa because I love it, Henny. as soon as COVID restrictions broke, we put together an outreach program, which involves multiple cities. And I think we'll talk a little bit about the Bloemfontein one in a minute. But I started in Cape Town and gave 4 different lectures there. And then last night flew into Johannesburg, where we're conducting a conference called Future African Space Explorers STEM Academy, which they abbreviate FASISA, fortunately, because saying Future African Space Explorers STEM Academy is too much to remember. And then I'll go on to Bloemfontein, and Mati is going to be my host.
And Bianca, how did you become involved?
Well, this time around, Jim, when he told me he was coming back for FASISA, he was looking for additional speakers, so I agreed, and I was actually happy that he asked, and I agreed to come and be a speaker. But initially, I started coming to South Africa because Jim, in 2016, invited me to come to SciFest Africa. And so I did that, and I did some outreach on that trip, and then came back in 2018, and we did a virtual reality workshop there at SciFest and did outreach there. And that's when I went to Sutherland and saw the darkest sky and the most stars I've ever seen in my life with my eyes. Great place to be. And then back again this year. I wanted to come in 2020, but nobody could go anywhere. So happy to be back.
Now, Jim, you're quite a frequent visitor to South Africa.
Yeah, this is my 15th trip to South Africa since 2013. That's like 2 times a year.
Well, glad to see you back. Bianca, let's just talk about how you are involved with the missions in NASA. I know you were involved or still are involved with a mission that's just been launched to the ISS. Would you tell us a bit more about that?
Okay. I work in a branch at Kennedy Space Center called the Exploration Payloads Branch, and we focus on testing payloads, all of the commercial resupply services missions that go to, you know, bring cargo and goodies up to the International Space Station. We check those out, and then we bring them over to the launch pad, integrate them in, or watch SpaceX integrate them into the capsule. And that's kind of what we do. So that happens, that late stow operation happens at about 24 hours before launch time. So we go over to the pad and take all that cargo, make sure it gets in there. And then typically there's about 2 launch attempts that we can leave that powered cargo in there. And if we don't make 2 launch attempts in a row, then we go back and deintegrate the cargo and bring it back to the space station processing facility and wait for the next launch attempt and bring it back 24 hours before. So really just making sure that payloads that need power have the power, payloads that need thermal control have their thermal control. Some of those are internal payloads, and some of those are payloads that are going to ride in the trunk.
So, Jim, it's quite a process to get the spacecraft or the launch vehicle from where it is built to the launch pad, isn't it?
Yeah, and everybody has a different sort of approach. So the SpaceX rockets that go out to the launch pad go out horizontally and then are raised vertically. And the NASA rockets that are stacked up in the vehicle assembly building go out standing up on a crawler and get out to the pad that way.
Yes, I've seen pictures of these crawlers. They're quite huge.
They're enormous. Yeah. Yeah, I could quote
a number of tons, but I know I'd be wrong. So best to look at
it. I think it's a million.
Is it a million tons?
I think it's a million.
My goodness.
And how are they powered?
I believe they're powered with diesel engines.
Yeah. And they move at quite a slow speed.
They do. You can walk faster than a crawler, which I guess that's why they call it a crawler, huh?
Okay, so just a question for Bianca. So you were talking about the payloads and SpaceX and so forth. So one gets the Crew Dragon, and then, of course, you get the cargo version. So can both of these take these payloads that you're involved in, or is it just the cargo dragons? And then another one on top of that, I mean, I guess you've seen so many launches already being involved in them. And, of course, these days the most spectacular is watching the SpaceX first stage coming back to land. So have you actually seen any of those before? Because, I mean, that's just the coolest thing out there.
Yeah, it is pretty cool. I have seen it come back a few times, and I've never seen it go wrong. I'll say that. So they're doing awesome getting it up, getting it back. It's interesting, you know. It comes back about 8 minutes after the launch. So, you know, typically, I mean, people who work at Kennedy Space Center for 30 years, everybody goes outside and watches a launch when it happens, and everybody waits outside when they're going to bring that booster back. So. It's interesting, and, you know, we all hear, you know, the sonic boom as it comes back and feel it. Yeah. And yeah, it's awesome.
It's like a reverse launch.
That can never go wrong.
When you see it land, though, on the pad, it looks unreal.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm like, how can the aim be that good? So it really does look unreal. Yeah, they can both take payloads, the Crew Dragon as well as the Cargo Dragon. So, I mean, obviously, they can take fewer payloads, in the Crew Dragon, but yeah, they both take them. And I think this time they have some biology research, and I think immunology research. So typically when we do the crew missions, it's a lot lighter. So we typically, with the cargo bringing it over there, we usually staff about three shifts. And the third one typically doesn't have to work unless something goes wrong. But we staff three shifts, and we carry it over there. But when we have the crew missions, we typically only have one shift. So that just kind of gives you an idea. We expect less cargo. So,
Bianca, I'm just curious whether you have any contact with the crew of a space mission when you are involved with the preparations before the launch.
So let me make sure. Is it just that do I interact with the crew? Oh, not during when they're going on the mission, because they typically go into quarantine. That's their typical thing. So they stay kind of isolated. So no, but I did have a chance to meet Jess Watkins, who did go up in this Crew 4 mission. So it was maybe a year and a half, 2 years ago. But when they come for a mission, they're pretty focused. And I mean, it's their family time. So I think they typically just stay in the crew quarters with they're able to see family and, you know, very few personnel. Now, I used to work in biomedical engineering and research. And so when we weren't launching crew, that was one of my funnest places to go, is into the crew quarters. And I mean, it's still, I think they refurbished it, but when I used to go in there, it still was like, it looked like, I mean, 1960s. Yeah, it was the Apollo era type look. And so, it was fun. I'd sit in the commander's chair, and when we had take a kid to work day, I took my friend's son and I let him put on some suits and sit in the chair and stuff like that. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool. And he's a lot. That was probably about 5 years ago. And, you know, every time I talk to him, that's the first thing he says. I remember when you took me. So yeah, definitely stood out.
Jim, you still have quite a lot of liaison with NASA.
Yeah, so I was part of a team at NASA that reviewed 8 existing missions that had reached the end of their science campaign to see if NASA should extend their science campaign. Usually the answer is yes, because you're already at Mars or you're already at Jupiter. And so, but the the point of the committee is to make sure that they're studying the right science and they haven't made any mistakes in terms of management and technical sorts of things. And so that was announced just last week. And so missions like Juno have now been extended. The Perseverance and Curiosity missions have been extended, those sorts of things.
There's a mission that's about to take place. I think I saw a photo of the craft, the Psyche mission.
Psyche mission. Yes.
What is that all about?
Oh. Psyche is a mission to an asteroid in the asteroid belt between Mars and Jupiter. And it's going to try and determine the makeup of this asteroid that they don't fully understand. And the reason the mission is named Psyche is that's the name of the asteroid that they're headed to. It appears to be a nickel iron core. Maybe it's the core of an early planet or planetesimal, and has evolved now to become an asteroid.
Mm. Interestingly, how do they choose, for instance, to go to Psyche?
It was through a competition.
Uh-huh.
So many proposals were sent in. NASA sent out a call for proposals. Many were sent in. And then that got whittled down to one or two. And then the bigwigs at NASA got to choose from that.
Obviously, just returning to the extension of missions, that has a budget implication, isn't it?
It does. But if you think about the balance, the largest part of the cost of a mission is already spent once you're there. So, I mean, we spent $1 billion getting Juno to Jupiter. And so now for a relatively small amount of money, we can get more science out of them. If the spacecraft is healthy, then we can get more science out of it. So there's a balance there. You know, you wouldn't want to turn off something that's operating when you can say when to go back, you'd have to spend another $1 billion. So that's one of those things. So really what this review does is make sure that they're looking at the right science questions. They're making the right kinds of measurements, and that they're not taking excessive risks with their management structure and preparedness and that sort of thing.
Mm. Bianca, if when you work on a mission like the one that's just been launched, is it one mission at a time, or do you work on different ones?
So we have, like for ISS, there's a launch manifest. So we kind of know, looking out, how many missions are going to be coming up. So that we're looking at what the schedule looks like. So that changes from time to time due to different priorities. Like we've been working with, we had the Crew 3 up at the International Space Station. So we sent them. Then we sent the Axiom 1, the private astronauts to the space station. Then even before all of that went up there, I think between Crew 3 and Axiom 1, we were supposed to send a cargo mission, SpaceX 25. But that then got postponed to June. And then we have the two capsules, Dragons, docked at ISS, and we want to send the Crew 4 mission. So we start to get into a logistics issue because we need Axiom 1 to come back before we can send Crew 4, and then we can get through Crew 3. So we had troubles with delay. You know, it's pretty precise. So we had troubles with delays of getting some of those back. So it pushed things back a little bit. And it seemed tight for a week or two, but just kind of hold tight. And then
now the Axiom project, those were sort of private individuals, isn't it?
Yes. So I don't know much about that mission, but we did support them because they don't. Some of the things that the tools like weight and center of gravity measurements and, you know, the batteries for the payloads, these are things that the private company doesn't have. So we, you know, NASA, in terms of facilitating this private mission, put those things kind of on loan to the company as government furnished equipment. You know, there's a fine line between how much do we help. You know, we help because it is a commercial project, and so we want to see them do it themselves without us. But in order to facilitate it and get them going, we, you know, give them some government furnished equipment so that they can make it happen. So, yeah.
At a higher level, I think it's important for the government to help commercial space because ultimately we'll all reap the benefit if there's more and more companies that are ready to go to space. Because you just never know when SpaceX may not be able to take our payload, so we could go with another company. And so I think we'll give them all fair treatment.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely fair.
And and assure that we'll do what we can to...
Jim? There are two names that we are hearing more and more about when it comes to space exploration and space missions, and that are the Falcon 9 of SpaceX and then also the Space Launch System of NASA. What will be the role of each of these in all these endeavors?
So there are requirements. So, I mean, the Space Launch System is an enormous rocket designed to push things to the moon. So it would be rare to use the SLS to go to the International Space Station. And it would also be a mistake because because SpaceX can do it and Orbital ATK can do it. And Boeing is working on
can
one.
Falcon 9 go to the moon?
So we... choose the rocket that fits the payload best, not only from a mass and volume standpoint, but also from a destination standpoint.
It can.
It can, and it will, won't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It'll carry cargo, but I think, yeah, it'll carry cargo.
But there. It will carry less than the SLS will, right? So if you're carrying a big, heavy habitat, for example, or some big, like the Gateway Station, will probably need an SLS, whereas the Falcon 9 will carry smaller payloads that need to go to the moon.
Or like a Falcon Heavy can go. Mm-hmm. Or even, I think, you know, when they get it all worked out, Starship will be able to do that as well. So
amazing. That's a new rocket that's in development.
Yeah. No, that's SpaceX, isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you compute... the payloads, the weight, because it sort of changes when you go away from gravity, isn't it?
So they have requirements on what each payload developer, what their weight and center of gravity measurements are supposed to be. So then they bring them in and we have a weight and center of gravity, you know, scale basically. And so then we, you know, organize it, configure their payload on there. So they configure their payload inside of their, we call them lockers. So it'll be inside of a locker. And then they need to position it so that they have their mass and their center of gravity where it's supposed to be. And then they bring it in, we measure it to verify. So,
yeah. And also at a higher level, the spacecraft or the rocket manufacturers have curves. So if you want to send a payload to, say, low Earth orbit, the rocket can carry so many kilograms. And if you want to send that same rocket to, say, geostationary orbit or geostationary transfer orbit, then the rocket needs to use more fuel, which means it can carry less payload. And so the curve will tell you, based on the altitude you want to go to, how much payload you can carry. And then when you get onto things like translunar injections, trajectories to the moon, then there are curves for that as well. So there are systems engineers that have to understand all of these things. But that's exactly right. The further out you go, the less payload a rocket will carry compared to what it could if it was just going to low Earth orbit.
What percentage of the total mass of a rocket is the payload? And how may that be affected by the distance of the journey and how fast the journey will be?
There's a lot that goes into that too, because then you would think, well, it depends how long, let's say you wanted to to get to the moon really quickly, then you're going to need more fuel and you're going to need be able to take less payload. But if you could wait longer, 30 days or 6 months, then perhaps you could take more payload. And so you, because you wouldn't need as much fuel. So it depends. And then, yeah, so you kind of have to match all the parameters and kind of get the right mix, I think, in order to get your cargo or your payloads to the location you want to.
Question for Bianca. So Jim just mentioned about kilograms, but when one listens to launches, you hear about pounds and miles and so forth that they use for measuring thrust and distance and so forth. So do you work in metric units or a mixture of metric and imperial? Of course, we know that there was a bad space accident a few years ago when they mixed up the metric and imperial units.
We work in kilograms for, you know, for our payloads. And even just when we look at what a launch vehicle, how much, what it can carry, it's done in kilograms. So I think, yeah, that mistake, those mistakes have made it clear that we just need to be consistent with.
Bianca, I've been thinking quite a lot about the following. We can imagine that a very big team of engineers are involved in the total process from the time of design of a rocket, it being built, preparations for the launch, and the actual operations of the mission itself. What does the mix of all these engineers look like? Say the percentage of those who are electrical engineers, mechanical engineers, and rocket engineers, whatever engineers may be involved.
Oh, the numbers, so I can only see what my, tell you what my perception is. So I definitely pay more attention when people are electrical engineers because we have that in common. Excuse me. But I also notice that there are a lot of mechanical engineers. And some of the most difficult problems in space, I think, are solved by the mechanical engineers, particularly, you know, the thermal control. So that's a big deal. And then the orbital mechanics. So all those, there's a lot of mechanical people, I'll say that. And then the systems engineers, there are lots of those as well. I don't work with as many systems engineers closely, but those are the people that are actually making sure that the projects that we work on, you know, are moving at the pace they're supposed to and that it's all going to come together in the end. So I can see that, you know, I always say I don't want to be a systems engineer, but I want to bring systems engineering thinking to my work because they think about the big picture. And, you know, I think that's important. So
And you know, just to run down the list, I mean, there's propulsion engineers, there's engineers that understand about the fuels that are used and how to load them. There's RF communications engineers, there's software engineers. So
a lot of them, you know, so I think one thing that I thought was interesting when I first went to NASA is how many people said, well, you know, I studied mechanical, but I work in this area now, you know?
Right.
So I think it's a good environment where, you know, if you're an engineer, you can come in, you bring that thinking, but there are so many ways you can develop other disciplines.
Yeah. NASA is a great place to do that too, because they do crossovers really well.
I have some good news for the people listening to this program. Jim Adams will be in Bloemfontein from the 6th to the 8th of May. That is now in this week. And one of the things that he will do is to present a public talk at the planetarium on Saturday evening, the 7th of May at 7 o'clock. People will have to book. And at the end of the program, I will give my cell phone number so that people can send me a WhatsApp if they are interested in booking for this talk. The topic of the talk will be what happened to the moon, NASA's Artemis project to the moon. Okay, now I'm back for fun. The topic of the talk will be what happened to Mars, NASA's Artemis project to the moon. We will also have a live stream of that talk on our Facebook. Facebook page, the Facebook page of Boyden Observatory and the Naval Hill Planetarium, but they can send me a WhatsApp if they are interested in the exact link.
Right, we have to close off there. Jim, normally people would find you on Facebook.
Yes, Facebook group. I love answering questions there, the RSG Sterren Planeta group.
Yeah. And our heartfelt thanks to Bianca Rim from NASA. It was interesting to listen to you and the work you do.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's fun. I didn't know it was going to be this fun, so yeah. I had a good time.
Okay.
Nice meeting you two that I haven't seen, but nice meeting you.
Marty, jou besonderhede?
Selfoonnommer 083-625-7154, 083-625-7154. En soos ek genoem het, die mense is welkom om 'n WhatsApp te stuur indien hulle belang sou stel om na die online stroming van Jim se lesing Saterdag aand te luister of indien hulle selfs wil bespreek.
Goed, en Willie?
So selfoonnommer 072-45-79-208.
072-45-79-208. En dan die program se e-posadres sterreplanete@gmail.com. sterreplanete@gmail.com. Tot volgende keer. Alles van die beste.